Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Namaste, motherfuckers. Welcome to Namaste, Motherfuckers, the only podcast where the worlds of work, comedy, and well-being collide. I'm your host, Callie Beaton, and this episode is called Monroe Bagging and Flat Earthers, and it contains some good old conspiracy theory bants. Top of the conspiracy theory charts are, coming in at number 4, Paul McCartney is dead. At number 3, Elvis is alive. Coming in at number 2, Big Pharma is withholding the cure for cancer. And topping the conspiracy theory charts at number 1, reptilian humanoids live among us with the intention of enslaving the human race. Obvs. I know I didn't mention moon landings or Bill Gates, but get over yourselves. It's my podcast. There's a conspiracy theory that the term conspiracy theory was coined by the CIA in the 1960s to discredit anyone who questioned the official version of JFK's assassination. Apparently, you're more likely to believe conspiracy theories if you're a narcissist. Rigged election, anyone? The Vatican's chief exorcist said that Harry Potter books are a turn to the devil, which I find less surprising than the fact that the Vatican has a chief exorcist. And Iran's state TV says the Potter books are a Zionist conspiracy. And here's one from my primate zookeeper son. A group of lemurs is called a conspiracy.
I can't quite hear you yet. I'm just getting myself sorted out. I'm gonna move to where my good microphone is.
That's my guest today, Mr. Ed Byrne. Members of the Flat Earth Society famously believe the Earth is flat. To clarify, Ed Byrne does not believe the Earth is flat. But a recent YouGov poll found that just 66% of American adults between the ages of 18 and 24 believe the world is round. Shit. And 2% of all Americans firmly believe the Earth is flat. Talking of flat earthers, Spanish football club Mostoles Balompi, I guarantee I didn't say that right, has renamed itself Flat Earth FC, with its president announcing the club is now dedicated to the Flat Earth movement.
Here we go.
How does that sound?
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. You're frozen on video, but your voice sounds good. Ed Byrne is a self-proclaimed outdoor trekking, cat-loving stand-up comedian. You'll know him from just about every comedy panel and TV show there is. He's what you could call a seasoned professional, having taken up stand-up back in 1993 when he was still at university. In fact, he gave up uni and became a stand-up. So kids, fuck uni, follow your dreams. He's also a keen walker and has recently launched his celebrity trekking podcast, Edventuring. See what he did there? Ed and I talked about horticulture, homeschooling, living under a flight path, pandemic-aged tour material, zookeeping, conspiracy theories, of course, science, humanism, getting angry, and the great outdoors. But I started by asking him about his upcoming tour.
I already did Cambridge Corn Exchange, played to 1,200 odd people.
But no need to show off, but that's very nice for you.
You know, but for some reason, I'm going back to the Junction to play to 120 people tomorrow.
So is the worry that some of those 1,200 will be there and they'll see you doing the same thing?
I am concerned about that. And I registered my concern with the promoter about that. And they said, no, don't worry. I'm sure it won't be the case.
We know that's not true, don't we?
I feel it's not true. I'm pretty tired. I mean, the poster is the same poster and the show title is the same show title.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people go, oh, hey, Bernie, I saw him, what, 18 months ago?
Oh, so again. You did it 18 months ago and now you're going back. Of course, because you're dusting it down post-pandemic.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
The question is, will they remember it better than you do? There's a good chance they will, Ed.
I actually did my first one back on Friday. No, last Wednesday it was. I drove down to Liskeard in Cornwall.
I know it well. I have a cottage near Liskeard in Cornwall.
Is that a fact?
Yeah.
Well, I wished I'd known that.
You could have stayed.
I wished I'd known that. I'm assuming you would let me stay in your cottage.
I'd have kicked
keys.
Out the Airbnbs and just put you in. I'd have been like, fuck you, Ed Byrne is in town. Did you pick Cornwall because it's a long drive and you needed the drive to learn your show?
No, they just asked. And I had been there before, I think nearly 10 years ago, and done a preview there, done an Edinburgh preview there. But I did listen to my own show on the way down and it was weird.
Did you like it?
I did, actually.
How many stars would you give it?
It was the finest comedy I've ever seen. Three stars. Or a bit ropey. Five stars. I realized it was a lot I had forgotten and I really did need to listen to it. But I did find myself going, that's quite a good joke, that.
Well, that's good. It's better than the other way around. But have you got things that have dated? I mean, presumably we don't all make our kids and ourselves age appropriate. I guess you have to be honest about your own age because people can Google that, but your kids could still be two. But were there things, what were the dated references where you were like, oh, shit, got to update that or ditch that?
Just a couple of one-liners here and there. There's a reference to the disappointment of the final season of Game of Thrones. That's just gone.
No one cares.
No, that's just what? Game of was that the one with Kevin Spacey? Like people I just can't quite
That's been long surpassed by Tiger King, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So that's but that wasn't a routine or anything. It was an easy thing to just let go as a just a little line. And another stuff, I have an extended routine about how men's rights activists crystallized around Mad Max Fury Road and how that was the start of the real MRA, men hating films with female action heroes in them.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest with you, now that film is even older, like when I was doing it before, that film was like,
you were pushing
six,
it
seven
before.
Years old.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now it's close to 10 years old. It feels more like I'm teaching a class in cinematic history.
Yes.
So it actually works better that's more dated.
Yeah.
Because I'm really going, I'm talking about, nobody cared about Sigourney Weaver in Alien. Nobody cared about Linda Hamilton in the Terminator films. But for some reason now, the knives are out for Captain Marvel and Wonder Woman and Star Wars. And this was the film where it all started.
Yeah.
And it just feels a bit more like, the fact that there's a bit more distance, It doesn't sound like I'm trying to be topical and failing. It sounds more like I'm teaching history.
So you're doubling down on the old material. I think that's good. That's a nice way to spin the outmodedness of some of
exactly,
our stuff.
Exactly.
And you've got, so you did, if your kids are, what age did you just say your kids
are? That's right. So they're now 9 and 10. So when when I was doing the show at the Edinburgh Fringe, they were 7 and 9.
Yeah.
Or 6, 7 and 8. And now they're 9 and 10, and like a lot of the jokes that written, like my stuff that my younger son has said, he was 6 when a lot of the stuff I'm actually talking about in the show was, because obviously even when you premiere the show in 2019, you've been writing it since 2017, you know.
Yeah.
So
he comes across as just a very, very slow.
Exactly.
Kid.
People are going, wow, his 9-year-old does not sound very advanced.
His vocabulary is awful. And he does, So your kids are coming across.
No, I do say. So he was 6 at this when this happened, and the other one was 8 when this happened, you know. So that's the kind of, that's where the creakiness is.
Yeah, it's always sharp when you have to explain that when you say,
But it's weird, even just phrases like, whereas before I used to, you know, like all the time you'll say as a comedian, you'll go, this happened to me the other day. And it could be 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Whatever. So I was talking to somebody the other day.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter to the audience that it wasn't actually yesterday.
Yeah.
But sometimes I'll say last year. And you kind of go, I have to change that because everybody knows that there's no way that could have happened last year.
They'll be reporting you for breaking lockdown.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I had a line in the show, which was my younger son, Magnus. By the way, that got me a round of applause at a comedy club in Reykjavik last year. Which it did. It did get me a round of applause in a comedy club in Iceland. The fact that I have a son called Magnus just on its own got a massive round
of
applause.
That's brilliant. How long did the applause last? Was that pretty much the whole show?
It was quite a while. I mean, yeah. I do a whole joke about the fact that it was the easiest round of applause I've ever had from a comedy club, which is telling them I had a son called Magnus. But I just have to change it to a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
In a way that normally it wouldn't make any difference to an audience.
Yeah, yeah.
If you say I was in Reykjavik last year, you're just aware people are going, he couldn't have been. We weren't allowed to go anywhere last year.
Yeah, he's not a Tory politician. He couldn't have gone abroad.
Yeah. So it's things like that. It's really little stuff. Even talking about, there's a routine about how kids get excited by shit that's not exciting. And I try not to ruin it for them and say the things, you know, I try not to bring them down. And I'm talking about getting on a plane. You've seen it, right? Getting on a plane with them. And the crux of it is that being on a plane is boring, but children think it's exciting. But now being on a plane is exciting because I haven't been on one. I've been on one plane in 2 years.
So how did you, because I saw you, I've seen you and I ended up gigging kind of twice in 2 days. I was starting to think I was your resident MC. It was in your rider that Callie Beaton must MC me. So how do you do, so that one you do, you have to caveat it.
I sort of
it
say
is,
a little line. I just sort of go with a little like, well, you've got to bear in mind this was written back when air travel was quite mundane.
Yeah. It kind of takes away the sharpness of it all that we're having to caveat things, I guess, and there'll be quick ways. The whole point of that one, I think, or not the whole point of it, but the rub at the end is that you live on a flight path. Is that are you underneath that flight path right now?
Yes, we haven't moved house around.
You haven't moved house. And that must have been quite nice. Yeah. In lockdown, was it nice to be for there to be no flights? Did you feel like it's a bloody good job someone ate that bat because it's just quiet for the first time?
I mean, there has been very few upsides to the whole economic slowdown, but certainly the silence in our back garden has been noticeable.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those things. Now I notice every plane.
And I think you'll have lost everyone at Back Garden because that became quite a bone of contention, didn't it? We all had to caveat the fact that, well, it's a shit garden and it's not really even a garden and it's more the size of a pillowcase, my garden. And
I have to admit, I do have a large back garden, but that's because I moved to the country.
Yes.
I am no longer an urban dweller. So
could we all have a large back garden if we lived under a flight path? Would that be one of your, because this is all about life hacks, right? Would that be one of your life hacks?
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. I mean, that's why they put allotments next to railway lines, you know.
Yeah. So
you've got to make use of the ground.
I thought that was just to improve the view for commuters. I never thought about it from the purpose of the owner of such allotment. And did you, so you've had the whole homeschooling thing, I guess, going on?
Little bit of that, yes.
Yeah, how's the marriage after that?
No, not bad, to be honest with you. And again, we were able to divide and conquer. I would sometimes be with one child while my wife was with the other. One child, the elder one, was pretty self-contained and the school were pretty on it with the distance learning. Magnus,
when you say self-contained, you were just like, let's assume the school's handling this one. We're going to put our efforts onto the other one.
He's pretty on it. He knows how to check it. We you know, you got to check, but you don't need to be on him quite as much as you do the younger one.
So you did all of that and you ended, because your wife works in the same business, right? You guys met each other at Edinburgh?
Yeah. My wife was a publicist in comedy.
And now she's
so
not.
She understands the business. She's just a stay-at-home mum, I believe is the term. But
I think you're going to take out the just, or we'll have Mumsnet trying to get the podcast taken. So try that one again.
Well, she used to be a stay-at-home mum and a publicist, and now she is a stay-at-home mum solely.
Well saved. And you have the lovely Bex Colwell as your PR now, I think, don't you?
She does. Yeah,
she did.
But we set this up ourselves.
Yeah. Oh, we did set this up ourselves. Bex, don't be offended. Given she knows us both, she might think, why did you do that? Yeah. We did. We set this up all without her.
So yeah. She has set up a bunch of interviews for me to do this afternoon with local radio.
Am I the first one of the day?
You are.
That's
but
good.
It's just coincidence that I put you in today and then Bex has put in a bunch more this afternoon.
Okay.
So I've got you and then a bunch of other interviews with local BBC radio and then I'm off to get my second jab.
Are you?
That's my day. That's a full day.
Well, we've started off with some rock and roll behind the scenes of Ed Burns' life. I feel we've done well. So you're not at the sort of junket stage where you've talked about your tour and stuff like 17 times today and I'm just going to get the kind of
putted. No.
Did I say that before?
I'm on my own at the moment as well. My wife and kids are off at or up in Derbyshire at my in-laws. So I've been on my own for a few days. So I'm actually quite chatty. You probably noticed most of my answers have been fairly verbose.
Yeah, really long and stuff I didn't even want to hear.
I don't envy the interviewers I still have to do on BBC local radio when they get on with me. You know, I'd be like, well, what about you? No, tell us. I just want to have conversations. I've just been living with myself.
That's why I have a podcast, because now that I'm in an empty nest, it's the only time I get human company some days. Mm-hmm. It's the cats or calling you, Ed. That's about it. That's all I've got. And over here, I haven't even got the cats. So are you, so in terms of your, you said, by the way, I was wondering if you've ever had this. I did a gig in Amsterdam on Saturday night. I did two over here on Saturday night. And I did the first one right after a Zoom gig. And they didn't do the breaks in what I consider to be a normal way. So mm-hmm. they put me on right after someone else I assumed that when you're closing, they'll have a break before you. Yeah. But they just went straight into me. So I didn't know I was going on stage. So what I'm saying is I arrived on stage with no thought I was about to do it. And it went fine, apart from I literally couldn't remember whether some of the things I was saying I'd said at the Zoom gig just beforehand or whether I'd said them at this gig, because I hadn't quite mentally turned up. So right. I was thinking, have I said that or did I just say that on Zoom? Have you ever been as stupid as that, that you're like, have I already said that in this gig where you're doubling up or tripling?
Rarely. I always like to, if I'm doubling up, try to do everything in the same order so as to not have that happen. I did repeat myself once at a late night. It must have been my fifth gig of the day, and I was mucking around with Adam Bloom on stage. And it's just a little ad lib. It was just a little thing about talking to somebody in the audience and how it can go wrong. Like, I always wondered if, you know, somebody like David Copperfield or any magician ever saying to somebody in the audience, have we ever met before? How unlucky it would be if the person in the audience says, yeah, we have actually met before. In fact, you fucked my wife, you know. And I just think how funny that would be if that ever happened. And I said that at the, something had triggered it. And I said that at the start of the gig when I was doing my gig. And then later on that same gig, I got on stage with Adam Bloom and we were just mucking around. And I said that again.
And how, so then people, and Adam an said, ad-fib, I know you don't, not an ad-lib.
Adam just went, you're so drunk, you don't realize you actually said that line earlier. And I was just so embarrassed because aside from anything else, it was a line, it wasn't even a line of stand-up. It was a line that I would come out with in the course of a conversation with somebody.
So it really was meant to look like
it looks like an ad-lib that's actually like a pre-prepared ad-lib. So I then repeated it. It just, yeah.
Well, I feel better about my Saturday night now.
Even the best comedians in the world will mess up. If you watch Bill Hicks's Revelations mm-hmm. special, which was filmed at the Dominion in London.
Which I have watched. What's the mess up in that?
There's a point in that. You'd notice it more if you've also seen him do some of the routines elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But when he does the thing about driving around on acid, mm-hmm. don't recommend it. Please don't appreciate fish driving around. He does a whole thing normally about being in one of those cars that talks and the car mm-hmm. saying the door is ajar, and how, you know, these guys are so, they're tripping, so they're laughing about it for ages, going, how can a door be ajar, how can a jar be on a car, all this stuff. And then later there's a cop pulls them over and he's tapping on the window, but they're looking at him in the rearview mirror and they're going, oh, he's a tiny cop, he's a little cop, put him in the jar is the punchline.
Yeah.
But in the Dominion, he doesn't do the bit about the door being ajar, because somebody has probably told them, oh, we don't have that here. We don't have the, you know, over here, cars just beep to let you know the door's open. We mm-hmm. don't have cars that say the door is ajar. Mm-hmm. So he obviously dropped that bit, but he still does the line of going, put him in the jar. And then you see him, as soon as he says it, and he just shrugs and goes, made sense to us. He's able to shrug it off.
And did he get a laugh?
It didn't get a laugh, but it's not like anybody was confused. He just was able to, because he's talking about tripping, talking about being on acid, the fact that he said something that didn't make any sense didn't really matter to the audience.
Yeah. And so also when you're him. It
looked like a glaring mistake. But if you're a mega fan and you know his stuff off by heart and you can see, but I'm just saying, that's in his special. You can actually see a great make a mistake.
Yeah.
Because anyone can.
And does it get easier that when you started young, right? You started at uni doing comedy.
Yeah, well, I dropped out by then. But yeah, pretty much.
So you dropped out.
I was 21.
Okay. So you dropped out of uni, started doing stand-up at 21. So you're now 7 years 49. Into your career. Yes, you're now 49. I know, I was looking at that. I realized that I've sort of missed a decade. I was looking at your date of birth. I was thinking, oh, he's been doing it 20 years. I was like, no, you've just skipped 10 years, Callie. That's a convenient thing to do at this stage in life. So you started very young and dropped out of uni to do it.
Well, no, I sort of dropped out of uni because I was going to be a gardener, and I decided I didn't want to do that anymore. And I also was fed up with being broke, and I also found it really hard. It was a BSc in horticulture I was doing, but a BSc is a BSc, and there's a lot of biology, physics, chemistry, and maths, and it was difficult.
Yeah, my son did a BA in animal sciences to become a zookeeper. Sorry, BSc in animal sciences to become a zookeeper. And similarly, he just wanted to be mucking out lemurs, and he had to do all that shit you're describing as well. Yeah. So you decided not to continue with that.
And I did. It was just I coasted through first year on what I'd learned at school, and then when it started getting really hard in second year, I went, I'm too lazy for this. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I stopped. And that's why I do nowadays get quite annoyed when people are sort of anti-science, because I'm really quite aware of how difficult science is. Mm-hmm. And I have great admiration for people who were clever enough and hardworking enough to stick with it. Mm-hmm. Because it's, you need to learn things and take the knowledge you learn in one lecture and apply that to some of the stuff then you're learning in the next one. You need to hold various different concepts in your head to be able to then understand the next level. And it's, really, you need to be smart. And it's very easy to just decide, no, they don't know that. And I went to a yoga retreat and actually I know more.
Yeah, well, I think there's been a lot of that, hasn't there, in the pandemic. I never thought something would split us as much as this pandemic has. Did you, in terms of us sort of, I never thought we'd just be discrediting whole swathes of, well, I suppose we've always been a bit split, haven't we, since the world of social media. Everyone's been able to sort of dive in and get really bedded in on their side of the fence. Someone said to me recently, and you I'm sure are familiar with this theory, but the theory about sort of anti-vaxxers or anyone who goes really doubles down on a slightly kind of what I would say a bit of a wacko kind of theory, it's about them being able to then have a following who think they're amazing and they know something no one else does. So people who perhaps have never been in a position where people look to them to be the voice and them to be the oracle, that's the kind of addictive thing. And that's what gets them so entrenched in their opinions. I don't know if you think that's just a charitable way of looking at conspiracy theorists.
I think mainly the thing that I find is conspiracy theories are an excellent way for people who aren't very clever to feel clever.
Yeah, I think that's what I was trying to say. But as you can see, I'm still learning to be concise. Yeah.
I'm not saying that everybody who's a conspiracy theorist isn't clever in some way, but it is a very seductive thing to rather than learn something, to simply say the people who did learn it are wrong. Mm-hmm. It's much easier than learning it. Much easier to spend, you know, just an hour on the internet looking at things without any kind of analytical sense and just going, you know, that sounds good. Rather than spending, you know, 7 years researching and getting a PhD in virology. You know, it's people are much rather think, yeah, you know what? Do you know if you eat local honey, it cures hay fever? That sounds great.
Yeah.
And it's much easier to it's one of those things that's just an easily digested notion. It seems to make sense on the surface.
Less syllables than antihistamine, easier to spit out.
But then if you go, well, okay, so what mechanism does that work by? It doesn't work. It's absolute horseshit.
Yeah.
But it's like going around telling people that there's no Santa Claus when you say, no, that's not true. And people just love it. A guy used to be in our circle. He was a dad at the school, and I just couldn't do it anymore. He would just come out with this shit. Like,
how did you handle it? Sidestep him or tell him you
was
a dick?
I just stopped talking to him. Yeah, I just went, stop, you know, talking. Like, he would just say shit like, "Do you know all pepper that you eat stays in your body?" And I'm like, "What?"
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've got, when you say pepper, like red pepper is chili pepper is pepper. No, pepper. You know, like, oh, so just ground pepper. Yeah. And where does it stay? And then then I'm the dick, because I'm going, maybe this isn't true, this thing that you're saying. Because it just sounds Good.
There was there's a documentary on Netflix about flat earthers that I found really
interesting. Yes, I watched that. Did you see that? Behind the Curve.
And what did you think about, because it was kind of the opposite of what we're saying, in that I loved the fact that they had some really reputable scientists, didn't they, commenting on it and basically saying that some of these guys do actually have the capacity to be great scientists, but for whatever reason, usually because they're social outliers, they've gone off piste and then been driven by confirmation bias. So all they've wanted are people who more and more, you know, buy into their theory. And these guys are like the kind of Beyoncés of the flat earth world, right? They go to conferences and they're heralded like rock stars. And this idea that perhaps what we should be doing when we see kind of outliers like that, who frankly, in the case of lots of them, just had sort of social interpersonal kind of issues, right, would be to try and bring them back into the mainstream, or at least give them the opportunity to be part of a mainstream discussion, rather than kind of laughing at them and pushing them further out. So it was sort of the opposite of what we're saying.
Well, I think once you reach the flat earth stage, you've already tipped
very
over,
very far gone.
I think you've gone through
the pepper in the body some time ago.
Flat earth to me is the logical conclusion to the personal universe you have to build around yourself when you start with anti-vax or global warming skepticism or anything like that, and people start throwing scientific facts at you. You build a bigger and bigger ecosystem around yourself to block out the facts that are coming at you, to the point where you don't even believe the world is round anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I think once people have reached that point. You know, I had a friend who, again, I just couldn't be doing with anymore, because we would just argue all the time. We had nothing in common anymore, because he just went deeper and deeper down the rabbit hole. And he was so annoying to argue with, because he would just say things that simply weren't true. And I said, okay, give me something that you don't believe, that's a conspiracy theory that you think is wrong. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, well, the moon landings. I don't believe the moon landings were faked. I said, okay, but you know how annoying it is to argue with people who do think they're fake. And he was like, yeah, I can see. Well, that's what you're like with this.
Mm-hmm.
And I checked in on him a few months ago on Facebook, and he is now a moon landing denier as well.
Oh, is he? He's progressed.
So I'm just saying, and in 5 years, he'll be flat earth. You know, it's because you can see it. Because it's very seductive. Because all you have to say, as I say, is just go, everything you've said is wrong. Yes, or that's what they want you to believe, or you're just a shit. And this is the other thing that gets me about it, is very often there isn't a desire to impart knowledge or a desire to change your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, it's the sneering. Most of the time, it's, yeah, you would think that because you're a sheep. It's that.
Yeah.
It's a desire to be superior to the idiots who believe what the government is telling them.
Mm-hmm.
It's that. So I find it very hard to take the more conciliatory attitude that you are displaying of where we should try and bring them on board and stuff like that. Because a lot of the time, the attitude that's coming from them is, we're all idiots and they're clever.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't be bothered.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a friend who's a GP who has another friend who's working on the wards. And she says it's incredible, because the only people in hospital with COVID now are unvaccinated people.
Mm-hmm.
90% of whom, like there's like 10% who can't get it for some reason, mm-hmm. but 90% of them are anti-vax. And it's like
Darwinism working well.
But it's not, it's like a support group.
Mm-hmm.
They're all in there together, mm-hmm. and they're in, the ward is an echo chamber, mm-hmm. and they're all convincing themselves and each other that they've still made the right decision.
How are they doing that? Refusing. That's quite a sleight of hand, isn't it, when you're actually in there?
In this exact same way, you have an entire conference of people who believe the earth is flat, but half of them flew on a plane to get there across the globe. They just are convincing each other. None of them want to admit that they're wrong, and it's incredible. And treating them is a nightmare because they some of them actually think that you're still lying to them. You're walking into a ward full of people you're trying to keep alive, all of whom think you're lying to them about what they've got.
Yeah,
she says it's insane.
Yeah, that does. It makes what we do for a living look quite straightforward, really, doesn't it?
But it is like it's a, you know, if you ever walk up in front of an audience and they just hate you for even fucking being there. It's like that. You know, so you get a really hostile crowd and they're all yelling, get off,
yeah.
You know.
Although that's 20 minutes, Ed, whereas I guess these were more 20-hour shifts. So before we get the NHS going, you know, you're talking shit.
Namaste, motherfuckers.
We actually met the first time at a humanist convention. I think it might have been in Belfast.
No.
And I was...
Oh, yes, it was. We did one in Belfast.
I think it was with Tim McGarry.
I remember it was working... No, it wasn't. We were working together in... It was Leicester.
Oh, was it? Because I did do one.
But Tim McGarry was there as well, yeah.
Yeah, Tim McGarry. I did do one in Belfast as well, but you weren't maybe at that one. Yeah. Interesting place to be talking about humanism, Belfast. Yeah. So we did one in Leicester. And do you find people, I don't know how much you talk about humanism kind of in the public domain, but do you find people kind of pile in on humanists with a sort of degree of ignorance or assumption?
There's certain beliefs that people like to argue with. Like, I have plenty of friends who are vegetarian, and it's just wearisome for them, because as soon as they say it, people just love to go, "Well, why are you wearing leather shoes?" Some people just automatically want to start a row with you because they think that you think you're superior to them or whatever. And so vegetarians get it a lot. But yes, atheists, it's not just if you say that you're an atheist, then you sometimes get the, well, you can't prove that there's no God. Fine. But the one that you get quite a lot is, why do atheists feel they need to organize?
Mm-hmm. That's how do you answer that?
I point out that you used to not be able to get married outside of a church.
Mm-hmm.
And now you can. You can now get married anywhere. It used to be registry officer, church, and that was your only two choices. Now you can get married pretty much anywhere you like. Mm-hmm. That's because of atheists getting organized.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just one tiny example. But there's also, people want to get married and people want to have funerals and they want to, you know, welcome their child to the world. They're three big things that people want to do. And they are milestones that the church has very much made its own.
Mm-hmm.
And people who don't believe in God tend to want to have an alternative, and the more and more alternatives are coming up and that's because of atheists getting organized. Mm-hmm. So the idea of a funeral where a guy who doesn't know the deceased just stands there and talks about God, a lot of people find that, if they don't believe in God, they don't find any comfort in it, and they also find, I'd really rather talk about the guy who's dead than talk about the imaginary being you believe in.
Yeah.
So humanist UK gives people resources to be able to do that.
And there's quite a link as well, I guess, between science and fact and humanism, in terms of it's really looking at attaching kind of prime importance to humans rather than thinking there are sort of divine or supernatural powers that would be controlling our destiny and how we should be living our lives.
Well, I think the idea that one should live one's life in accordance to, you know, in order to please a supernatural being seems to me an odd way to live your life. And I always find it weird when you get into a discussion and people say, well, then what's stopping you? What's stopping you from going around killing people? Like, really? Are you saying that the only reason you don't go around killing people is because God's going to punish you when you die?
Yeah.
Surely you have an innate sense of morality that prevents you from going around killing people.
One would hope.
I would have thought.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a hunch.
I guess it's
also almost an excuse to sort of take away the idea of anything to do with psychology and nature and nurture and personality traits and so on. If we're saying we're guided by one set of rules that we're doing unquestioningly and moving through. But it's an interesting thing how people do have quite strong opinions about it, almost confusing humanism with Satanism, which is ironic, really, I think, when you think about it in terms of these awful people.
Have you had that? Have you had people?
I've had people not. My kids went on Camp Quest, which are summer camps. I don't know if you've heard, I would quite recommend them if your kids are, if you're looking to farm your kids out ever in the summer. But my kids would go to this, it's actually a big American thing, and it came over to the UK 10 years ago. And it's human, you don't have to be a humanist to go, but it's summer camps for kids. They go for a week, and they do kind of, they have like philosophical kind of, it's a bit like a uni model of a holiday camp. So they do kind of sessions and lectures, and the kids can speak about things that it's kind of quite intellectually stimulating in the morning. And then in the afternoon, they go kayaking and falling off walls and all the kind of usual shit that kids would do. And it's quite, and people would definitely, when I said my kids were going to Camp Quest and asked what it was, people would be really kind of like, I think they thought they were joining a cult or something. They were like, well, why are they going to that? You know, what's like quite suspicious of it because it wasn't the summer camp that all the kids go to.
Right. Yeah. Oh. Well, so, I must bear that one in mind.
Yeah, write that one down. And in terms of just going back to the comedy, for this is a comedy podcast. So I was going to ask you when we were talking.
We've been quite serious so far.
We really have. But my editor's going to be like, oh, let's just cut this. It's like 7 minutes at the end where you talk about your tour, your podcast and a joke. But in terms of people getting to see you, so I'm interested, we had a conversation at one of the gigs we did recently and you were saying, you know, it's all right for me in a way because I've kind of, you know, at least people know who I am, I can get back into it. And you said, imagine being one of those comedians who's like 5 years in and everything's opening up for them and they're really making it and then the world shuts down. And I was like, that's what happened to me.
That's what happened to you, yeah.
Literally so many nice things that about to happen fell apart and haven't quite. Some of them are coming back, some may not, I don't know. But in terms of the sort of material you do, so if you were doing stuff in the 90s, that was really kind of gag heavy, right? The circuit at the time, there was no flesh on the bone, you just had to knock out crowd pleasing gags
pretty much.
Yeah,
I mean, there were other people doing other stuff, but yeah, it was very I grew up, as it were, in that very sort of gladiatorial jonglers, late shows, you know, and where you it was very, you had to be kind of really in your face and quite aggressive. Yeah.
And there was a lot of kind of shouty comedy in the 90s, right? It was totally. The kind of get on, shout a lot, do it, you know. And so that's a huge departure in a way from the sort of comedy you do now, but also possibly because people are coming to see you instead of just coming to see comedy. Is there a shift you can make once they're Ed Byrne fans rather than comedy fans?
I think you're given a certain amount of luxury, when people already know who you are, where you don't have to prove yourself as much. But I'm still pretty shouty at times, and I've seen you shout.
You've blown my hair back behind my ears with the volume.
There's still a lot of manufactured anger going on.
Is it manufactured?
Well, I've always thought it funny. One thing I've always found funny is watching somebody get angry about something that's not that big a deal.
Yeah.
You know, that is in itself, I think, quite humorous.
Yeah, it's what we live for at airports, right? Seeing people do that, seeing relationships fall apart and people getting so angry because their suitcase won't wheel.
Yeah, exactly. But even just seeing people, like comedians, just getting, like, I just remember even Eddie Izzard just doing a thing about, I think it was oranges, but how hard they were to peel. And at the end of it, I said, so oranges can fuck off. And it's just such a disproportionate response to simply a fruit that's hard to peel to say that it can fuck off. I think that sort of misplaced anger is in itself, whatever the subject matter is, it's funnier than getting really angry about something that's actually, you know, that's political, that's actually really important and you should be getting angry about.
And do you get angry about those things in real life, or is it very much staged for the comedic effect of being a disproportionately angry man?
I yell at inanimate objects.
Do you?
I could
see that almost happening when you were trying to set up the podcast today.
Yeah. I had a sat nav that we ritually smashed with a hammer at the end of the tour once because it just kept messing up. There was just something slightly wrong with the screen. And you'd be pressing it and nothing would happen. And then suddenly loads of whys would come. Anyway, it was an older one, you know. But I have literally screamed at that in a way that my voice wasn't up to the gig. With like, really? I scream, you fucking fuck! Like that. At an inanimate object because it kept malfunctioning. And really, I'm angry at myself that I haven't replaced it.
Yeah.
And I'm making myself late because this thing that I know doesn't work is still in my fucking car delaying me. But I get angrier at that than I ever would at a human being. But, you know, people have said that it's frightening. And I think because I know I'm not a big guy and I'm quite a sort of fey, wimpy bloke, I think it doesn't matter how angry I get, but I have been told by other people that it can actually be quite frightening how angry I get sometimes.
When they're in the orbit of it, even though it's not directed at them.
Yeah. Exactly. And even if I am having an argument about something, again, quite inconsequential, whether Star Trek The Next Generation is better than the original series Star Trek, it could be anything, that apparently I can get quite intense in a way that's like, what's this guy's problem?
Yeah.
And I think the reason I do is because I think of myself as so unthreatening and unintimidating that I allow myself to become angrier in a way that actually is quite off-putting to a lot of people.
You think you've got a long way to go to be an aggressive Neanderthal kind of a guy, so you've got plenty of slack to be beating
exactly.
inanimate objects.
Yeah, I think people will just dismiss me as like a Jack Russell, you know, just nipping. I think that's how I view myself when I'm getting angry about stuff. But apparently, even a Jack Russell, if it goes, is actually...
The only dog that's ever bitten me in my life is a Jack Russell that actually properly tore into my calf. So there you go. You've used the wrong animal as far as I'm concerned.
Maybe I've written the perfect animal because I think of myself as a Jack Russell, but maybe I am actually...
You're a yappy little bastard who will bite. What do you think about the anger in the pandemic then? Do you think... I've noticed it particularly on the road when I'm driving. People are so fucking angry at the moment on a level I've never... I'm wondering if it's the sort of real life equivalent of hiding behind a Twitter handle and just spouting shit, that when people are in their car, they're like, I can be a dick. My windows are shut. I'm out. Have you noticed that?
I think that's all. Well, I haven't noticed it to a greater extent. I've always, I mean, that is a common thing, that road rage is again, so out of, so disproportionate to the crime committed, the anger that people will indulge in. I think perhaps people are quite out of practice driving.
Yeah.
And I think people are back on the roads. And also the roads are far more congested than they normally are because nobody's gone abroad for holidays. So so I think that's what's contributed to it, really. There's just more people and they're all driving quite badly.
Talking of the pandemic, so you've always loved walking. And as a mini walker, so I run more than walk, but I do love walking. I live near Hampstead Heath and I've always run and walked on Hampstead Heath for the last 2-3 decades. And it really pissed me off in the pandemic. I was like, my lovely local Hampstead Heath is full of people who don't even like Hampstead Heath, which is a very first world thing to have just said. But how did you feel about everyone getting into the great outdoors when really it's always been your great outdoors, not theirs?
Well, I've always liked the idea of trying to encourage other people to get into the great outdoors. My problem was that the great outdoors was shut for most of the pandemic.
Yeah.
You know, the Lake District was shut.
Who knew they could shut the Lake District? That was
Scotland was shut. They shut Scotland.
I know.
I remember when we were shut down in March 2020, I remember thinking to myself, right, kids are home and then we'll have the summer. And I remember thinking optimistically, I'm looking forward to September 2020 because the kids will be back at school. I won't be back at work. I'm just going to go to Scotland and just go walking. And Scotland went, no, you are not coming here. And the kids only went back to school for a bit, and we were still locked down pretty hard again. I did a bit of walking in October, which is when I was able to film the 4 episodes of the adventuring YouTube thing that I do. But then we were shut down again. So yeah, I thought that going onto the hills would be the silver lining of the pandemic, and then even that was taken.
And how is that for you? Because as somebody, I definitely, the running for me is largely about mental well-being. So just being with me, it's probably the most mindful I ever get, and with my thoughts and working shit out, literally grounded on the ground.
Yeah.
It's also green and nature. And I've never realized how much I need to see green around me, as I did once. I got pneumonia in a hotel in the middle of New York on Times Square. And they did hospital treatment in the room. And I was in this horrible... I just thought, God, what wouldn't I give to see a plant, a tree? I never realized. I've always lived in cities since I've been an adult, but I never realized that. So for you, what is the, I mean, I know you know, you're good at it. So you're properly kind of fit. You're more than a sort of ambler. You're more than Theresa Maying it, although maybe she is really fit. I don't know. But is the, what is it that it brings to you?
I love going, it's going uphill, up and down hills is what gets me. I think just a simple walk in the country isn't enough for me.
So you need the hills,
if it's flat, I go for a run. I went for a run yesterday for the first time in a long time, and it's really,
how was it?
really has broken a bit of a cycle of just doing nothing.
Yeah. Could you do it still? Did you have enough residual fitness?
I just
did
5K.
Yeah.
And it was about 27 minutes. So it wasn't
fast. It's not so bad after not running for so long.
I know. Yeah. But I mean, like a couple of years ago, I was doing I was doing the odd 10K and managing to do it in less than 50 minutes. So yeah. I was.
Which is a good pace.
I got
listeners.
Pretty good at running.
Yeah.
And now I've got bad. But yeah, I've gotten into a bit of a cycle of just waking up hungover and not feeling like doing it all day and then just getting drunk again that night, you know, whilst not working. And
how is that? Because you're sort of half.
Of purpose.
You're half joking about it, or maybe you're not. But the thought going into those cycles of, I don't know if it's the same for you. I'm definitely all or nothing. I'm either, I'll get up, I'll write, I'll be mindful, I'll run, I'll moderate my alcohol intake and I'll eat the right things. Or I'm like, I don't care. Everything goes to shit. I'm not very good at the middle ground. And you only liking your uphills and your downhills. How are you with the kind of middle?
Yeah, no, I'm a bit sort of, I find it very easy to just slip into doing nothing. And again, first lockdown, I dug a vegetable patch. I moved sheds around in the garden. I built this terraced, sunken patio with flowers all around. I went all out. I knocked myself out.
Full lockdown cliche.
Doing, all kinds of stuff. And now I can't even bother to refill the bird feeders. Like, I've got a real kind of, what's the
There's
point?
A sentence I never thought I'd hear.
Yeah, I know. Because proper depression is a more serious thing and I'm not labeling myself in that way, but I'm definitely feeling myself get the blues. And yesterday, as I said, I went for a run and it made a massive difference, you know. So I'm definitely feel like I'm actually on an upswing out of what has been a bit of a low ebb.
And the walking must be, if you are someone who loves proper kind of trekking and really, you know, what's the name for people who love going up, bagging?
Well, Munro bagging is a specific subset of hill walking. Munro's at the Scottish mountains above 3,000 feet. There's 282 of them.
How many have you bagged?
I have done 115, I think, 117.
Bloody hell.
So, and they're dotted all over Scotland as well. The furthest south is just above Glasgow is Ben Lomond, but they go all over. And I've done the most northern one, most eastern one, and the most western one.
And do you bag them on your own, or do you do them?
A lot of them I do, simply because it's hard to find people who are free when I'm free.
Rod Gilbert's not always available, is he?
No, well, Rod only, we did a hike in Pembrokeshire, me and Rod.
Yeah, I watched it. I loved it.
I used to go, there's various people I used to do it with for one reason or another. One friend of mine who's now, on his way, that guy I was talking about before, who's now a moon landing denier, used to go with him a lot, but he had his hip replaced anyway, so he can't get up the hills anyway.
But, and you literally can't get away from that shit when you're up a mountain with somebody and they start spouting that kind of crap. It's hard to say. Anyway, listen, the washing is taking out the machine. I've got to go now.
You know yourself, as a comedian, you're working weekends and you're free at weirder times. So it's hard to find people who are free when you're free to do it. So inevitably, I end up doing it on my own a lot.
And do you, that must be, no, I just had a kind of a, it wasn't COVID, but I was ill for a couple of weeks with like a bronchial thing. And it was so annoying. I was like, who gets ill at the moment? It's very unfashionable to get ill with something that's not COVID. And it meant I couldn't gig and I couldn't run. And I realized without those two things, my mental health within about 48 hours took a massive plummet. And I thought, wow, if someone actually took those two things away from me permanently, I do not think my sense of self is as robust as I'd like it to be. So is, I guess, the things that have always kept you going, right, as an adult. I mean, I know you have a wife and kids and that's all hugely important in terms of grounding you, but if comedy and the outdoors are the two things you need, this has been a shit show.
Yeah. It really has. And I got out to, I had a gig. I was gigging in the Midlands and then I had 2 days off and then I was gigging in North Berwick. So I drove up and I stopped off in the Lake District for a couple of days and did some hiking there, and it made a world of difference. Although even then, I filmed myself while I was doing it for my YouTube channel, so I was still kind of became work, and it's still but.
Are you filming yourself when you do that stuff then? So how are you doing?
Exactly. And I was, well, on this occasion I was, And it's an experiment. I haven't edited.
Because adventuring, you've got someone filming you, presumably.
Yes, exactly. I got Barry Castagnola filming it. But I did, yeah, I did think of actually putting the camera on a tripod and then getting back and then walking past it. So it made the whole thing seem very artificial and analyzed. So I don't, you know, it made it less enjoyable, but it was amazing to be out there and to just sit on top of a hill. I don't know what it is about going up and down hills that I like. I should really have an answer to the question, because I get asked it a lot. What do I get out of climbing mountains? And I have no idea. But I just know I find walking, just general country walking, isn't that thrilling. I'd rather go for a run or go get on my bike. But I love, my favorite thing is when you get to the top of a hill on a two-hill day. When you're on the top of a hill and then you can see the top of the other hill you're going to do. Yeah. And sometimes it's quite a dispiriting amount of height you have to lose before you then gain the second hill. But there's just something about being on top of a hill and knowing you've got one more to do before home. I find that very...
It sounds to me as if you've just picked a metaphor for all your life choices. So you've picked your career is up a hill. Sometimes you're going down here. You see the hill you're going to go up to. And then you literally go. So, yeah, I would say Ed Byrne, never a fan of the flat, would be. That's what I'm going to say at your funeral if I get the invite. So, and I've just got to ask you, before I ask you the questions I ask everybody, as a massive Americanophile and having worked for American TV companies most of my career, you've done 5 appearances on Late Night with Conan O'Brien, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
5. So go on, you've just got to tell me what it is like. I would just so love to do stand-up on, obviously now it would be with Stephen Colbert. What is it like doing that?
It's very nerve-wracking. And even though it's not live, there's very little to gain and everything to lose. So I don't know why I put myself through it. Because
it was a mountain that you needed to get to the top of.
Yeah, I think I just fancied it. But maybe 2 million people will see it in a country of over 300 million. So it's an insignificant amount of audience. But if you die on your arse and you get cut from the show, you'll never work in Hollywood again.
Yeah.
So it's really...
How long do they give you? So, I mean, because I used to
work
on...
4 minutes, 3.5 minutes, maybe 4.
Yeah.
And you do... Stu Smiley, who's the segment producer, will go around... You'll go around clubs the night before, maybe the 2 nights before, going from club to club... Just getting your 4.5 minutes, your 4 minutes down, just trying it out. And because he's the guy from Conan O'Brien, he can just get you on everywhere. Mm-hmm. We got a guy who's on the show on Thursday. Can we come in and can he run a set? And they're always happy for you to do it. And so you go in. So it's like going to the gym and training to make sure you get it just right. And the one time I didn't do that, because I was at the Montreal Festival, the first routine I did didn't work.
Really?
I got it back with the second routine, but I did a routine about leg warmers.
So then what happens?
Still stayed in. It was okay.
Okay.
But it wasn't as strong. So of the 5 I did, that was the weakest one.
And is it like Apollo, that when you've done it, they're like, that's it. Now you've burnt that material. You're not supposed to be doing that material elsewhere anymore. Or you can do what you like.
No, I think you can still continue to do it. Because as I say, it's such a small proportion of people who have actually seen it for the population of the country.
Namaste, motherfucker.
What would you pick as your namaste motherfucking moment?
I mean, I think it would probably be the last time I ever did an open spot, which was at the Jonglers in Camden. Mm-hmm. And I remember Tim Clark was hosting. And it was, I always say, it was like the final scene in a film about a young man who wants to be a stand-up comedian, because it just, I just had this 5 minutes down, and it was, again, it was quite in your face, aggressive. There was not an ounce of fat in it. It was joke, and it just went so well that they put me onto weekends straight away. It's very hard to tell the story without sounding really, really conceited, though.
Go on, go full arsehole on it.
Well, there was a moment where the crowd started chanting, "We want dead, we want dead." You see, the thing is, when you're an open spot...
Sure, this isn't a dream.
I swear to God, this is what happened.
There are witnesses.
Here's the thing. This is why it was like this final scene of a the scene of a movie.
It's like Mrs. Maisel.
I didn't even know this until afterwards. The venue manager told me afterwards that just after I got off stage, the guy who owned the club had phoned about something else. And the guy was on the phone to the owner of the club. And then as an afterthought, the guy said, oh, and how did the open micer do? And it was right then that the crowd were chanting. The guy said, open the door there, will you? And they pulled open the door and he held up the phone to the crowd chanting, we want Ed, we want Ed. And he went, that's how the open spot went. And he said, oh, well, I guess we put him straight onto weekends then. So it was, you couldn't write that.
What a shame that it was before the days when we would always be recording our stuff on voice notes as open micers so that we can improve on it next time.
I never recorded my stuff. I recorded myself
once. Because you didn't have a ghetto blaster and it was the early 90s.
No, I had a dictaphone.
Yeah,
I had a dictaphone.
Did you have it next to your Filofax?
I never had a file of facts. I have a file of facts now, excellent. But I just use it to keep notes on my planting in the garden.
That is anyway, the least showbiz thing anyone's ever said on the podcast.
But I had a dictaphone and I recorded an open spot I did at the Ballon Banana and I died on my arse. And that was it. I went and I never taped my open spots after that.
Because it was just silence.
Because
just
the one time I did, I died on my arse. And even though I'm not superstitious, I just went, right, well, I'm not doing that again.
I don't mind the taping them. It's the listening back. When you're doing a whole show, do you not record yourself and listen back to it then? Because that's the bit that's actually put me off doing another solo show. I hated the listening back and tweaking so much.
I mean, as I say, it was a painful experience listening to my own show whilst driving to Cornwall. Usually I don't like to listen back.
Okay, but I like that.
I do have a record. I don't have it anymore, but I did record myself dying on my arse for 5 minutes at the Ballon Banana. Where I got one line, I got one joke, I got one laugh, which was at the end, because I was smoking a cigarette. That's how long ago it was. Mm. And at the end of the set, I said, they say that every cigarette you smoke takes 5 minutes off your life. It's just a shame you don't get to choose which 5 minutes. And that was the only reason.
Was that an ad lib?
That was an ad lib.
Yeah, that's a good one. Was. Shame we can't use that anymore as we won't be smoking. And what is your favourite joke?
My favourite stand-up comedy routine is Larry Miller's Five Stages of Drinking, which I urge people to look up.
Yeah. I'll put that in the show notes. Good call.
But one of my favorite jokes that anyone's written, I think, Lee Mack. Lee Mack has a great line, which was, I used to think I wanted three children until I had two. And now I realize I only want one. And I think that's just, I just think it's a beautiful joke. Lee Mack now has three children, by the way. But I absolutely love that joke.
He writes, his work ethic is phenomenal, isn't it? He just writes and writes. It's kind of it's the opposite of your drinking all night, Ed, and feeling on a bit of a low. He would be there at 8 o'clock, metaphorical pen in hand, writing for 8 hours, come rain, come shine.
Well, it's paid off. He's a funny bloke.
Yeah, it's paid off all right for you as well. And I think your approach is more appealing to many people. Not saying that you're a slacker. So, Ed, if there was one bit of life advice you could give to anybody listening, what would it be?
Oh, I find some way to remember things. I realise that now this probably doesn't apply so much anymore because everybody's recording everything on their phone anyway. And your phone will spit out memories of things that happened 6 months ago or last year. So it's kind of being done for us now. But there's a lot of stuff that I just did or went through or even jokes I wrote 20 years ago that I've just forgotten. There's people I've forgotten. There's just all this stuff that I've forgotten. And I wished I'd kept a diary. I wished I'd kept some sort of a log of just where I was and what I was doing. Because even without your memory going, even without, you know, just not being as sharp as I used to be, just stuff you just can't be expected to remember that mm-hmm. much of your own personal history. Mm-hmm. And I kind of regret some of the stuff that I just can't bring to mind now because I don't have any even keepsakes or notes to just bring me back there. I kept a diary when I went on holiday to the Grand Canyon back in 2002, and I kept some notes. I just wrote notes just to remember what happened on each day.
And have you still got them?
And I did, yeah. And I found them again. I was just looking at them. And that brought it back in a way that just trying to remember that holiday wouldn't.
Yeah.
So that would be my advice. You know, just write shit down. if you're enjoying yourself or, you know, whatever, just keep a little bit of a diary and put it somewhere safe, because you will need that to bring a lot of memories to mind. And if you've got that aid memoir, it's quite rewarding. That would be my advice.
I'm just wondering if someone said to you, listen, we really want to get the autobiography done. And you're like, and they're like, no, you just dig it. And no, you're like, oh, shit, I've got
nothing. No one has asked me to do an autobiography. Well, and I'm not sure that I would either, even if I was asked. I think my tendency to overshare would burn a lot of bridges with an autobiography.
Those are the ones we like. Those are the ones we want. That was the wonderful Ed Byrne. Now, every episode, as you know, I pick a thing inspired by my guest that I am going to try. And this week, I am going to find a hill that I can climb. I mean, I can't say I'm going to bag myself a Munro just yet, but I might at least make it to the North Downs. So, lovely listeners, that is it for this week. Before I go, a big shout out to you for supporting the podcast. Please remember to rate us on iTunes, leave a review if you haven't already, and keep on spreading the good word. Namaste, motherfuckers. So we'll be back in your feed next Monday, as always, when I will be talking to comedian, writer, and host of the hit BBC podcast, No Country for Young Women, Sadia Azmat.
I guess I discovered comedy in my teens. It was really naughty, and it was the only vice I guess I could access.
Namaste Motherfuckers was written and presented by me, Callie Beaton, and produced by Mike Hansen and Karusha Dummy for Pod People Productions, with music by Jake Yap. I'm Callie Beaton. Until next time, motherfuckers.